Welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words. I am your co-host, Judy Alexander, and I'm here with my husband, Dr. Bruce Chalmer.
Hello, listeners. Hello, Judy. We have a really exciting interview today. It's an interview with Barbara and Doug Martin. They are a couple raising kids in Vermont, and we happen to know them because we're members of the same synagogue. And they are an interracial and intercultural Jewish couple raising kids in a state, Vermont, that doesn't have a whole lot of Black people and doesn't have a whole lot of Jewish people. And so they've got a lot of really interesting things to say. We already did this interview a few days ago, so we know what's in it, and you're in for a treat. This podcast, you found wherever you found your podcasts. What we'd like you to do is help us spread the word, help us get it so that it sort of goes viral, not the way the COVID-19 goes viral. We want it to go viral as opposed to wanting it to peter out. So what we hope you will do is comment and give us ratings and things like that on iTunes or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Also, share our posts on social media. And if you think this is interesting stuff, tell your friends about it. Our podcast, as you know, if you've heard them before, is based on my book, Reigniting the Spark: Why Stable Relationships Lose Intimacy and How to Get It Back. And that the formula referred to, the 7 words referred to in our title, is
be kind, don't panic, and have faith.
And what we've been doing in our podcasts that don't have interviews is going through the various chapters of the book. So I think our next podcast, I don't think we have an interview lined up for, we'll see. But if so, it's going to be continuing our exploration of that formula. We'll tell you about that after the interview. So without further ado, let's move on to the interview. The first thing you'll hear will be Judy introducing our couple.
Our guests today are Barbara and Doug Martin from Shelburne, Vermont. Originally from Uganda, Barbara Martin lived in Italy for several years before coming to the United States in 2001. Barbara earned her associate degree in Management Information Systems from Northeastern University and her Bachelor of Science and Master of Public Administration degrees from the University of Vermont. While in Boston, she met her now husband, Douglas Martin, in 2001. Barbara moved to Vermont in 2003 and got married in 2004. That same year, Barbara and Doug joined Temple Sinai, a Reform congregation in South Burlington, Vermont. That is, incidentally, where I am the education director and Bruce and I are members. After a couple of years, Barbara became a Jew by choice to better understand the Jewish religion and later help guide their 2 children, Eli and Emma, as they went through their religious education. Barbara is a very involved member of Temple Sinai, where she now leads the membership committee and serves on the board. She also serves on the board of the Champlain Valley School District and the Town of Shelburne Social Action Committee. Doug Martin is from a small suburb of Boston, but has been coming to Vermont his entire life to ski and hike. After receiving his Bachelor of Science degree in economics from MIT and working for a number of years at his family's contracting and engineering business, he decided to settle in Vermont permanently and pursued a law degree and master's in environmental law at Vermont Law School, graduating in 1997. The way Doug sees it, after his parents introduced Barbara to him in early January 2001, it took all of 2 years before she finally moved to Vermont in 2003 to be with him. Their life together has been one long happily ever after ever since. 2 great and happy kids, both recently bar bat mitzvah at Temple Sinai, a wife who wakes up way before him, or in other words, lets him sleep late, and no pets to distract. For years, Doug served on the board of the Vermont Mozart Festival. He now serves as the president of Temple Sinai and claims he is the most secular president ever. Doug relates that their very first event at Temple Sinai was a bris for their son. Between their 2 families and friends, the social hall was packed to capacity, and the bris was turned into one big celebration. They were told that that had never happened before at Temple Sinai and have had a reputation to maintain ever since. Barbara and Doug, welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's beautifully done.
Barbara, I want to talk to you first. When you were a child in Uganda, did you think that as an adult you would be living and raising your children in Vermont? And and become Jewish?
Not at all. I even never thought I would be in the U.S. As I always remind Doug that I was meant to be. I was on my way because I never knew this was going to happen. It was destiny and it was going to happen. But it never occurred to me that I would be outside of Uganda.
How did it happen? What was the sequence of events that where you ended up here?
So the secrets of events were I was one of the few people who were selected to go to India for education to one of the universities. So Uganda was starting an exchange program, and I was one of those students. So my father thought, well, before you go to India, you better go to Europe. And Europe, that meant my sister who was in Italy, so that you can get some clothing, because who knows what's in India? It's cold, it's warm, so that you can get the appropriate attire. So I get on my way to go to Italy. And from Italy, I remember my siblings saying, why would you go to India again? We don't see why. Think about an education in Europe, an education in India. Compare that. And even though I was an older teenager, no, actually in my almost late, maybe 20, I had already hit 20, maybe. I don't remember. But I still was your young 18, 17-year-old kid. So I listened to my older siblings and I thought, well, if that's what you guys think, you are more experienced. So I chose to stay in Italy for my education. And being in Italy, nobody thought about the language. So I didn't speak any Italian. So I decided to go in tour and travel because I figured if I went in a tour and travel, that's an area that I can use my geography. Geography is the same. It doesn't matter the language. So I chose tour and travel and I went into a technical school, after which I was able to get a job and started working. However, I felt I needed some education because that's what my father always said. Somebody should go to college. And among all the 9 kids, nobody had ever made it to college.
Wow, 9
So
kids.
I had a sister who was in Boston, and she's like, you should come here because everybody, you know, here there are so many schools, you know, you have opportunities to go to university and all that. And I came to visit, long story short, I came to visit, and she said, well, if you take the bus here, and, you know, she was in Watertown, and she said, if you take the bus to Copley, the stop there, you just have to walk, you'll find a university. And that was Northeastern. And I went in. I remember I was just visiting for a week. And I arrived, and they had SATs going on that time. You know, as I walked into the office, she said, if you want, you could take your SATs, because that's one a requirement for an international student. And I said, okay. So I took my SATs. And then I asked what's next, and because I have to leave, I was just visiting, and she said, well, if you want, we could also give you the I-20. Then international students needed an I-20. And I said, I have to leave next week. How fast can that process be processed? She said, well, it takes just 2 days, as long as you can come back and pick it up. I said, okay. So they got me the I-20, and I was able to go back to Europe and get my visa, and I came to the U.S.
Did you grow up speaking English? Did you know English, or was that a language you needed to learn?
Yes. So in Uganda, we have about 50, I think 54, if I'm not mistaken, tribes, and each tribe speaks a different language. So when you go to school, we all have to study in English, and we are not. The reason you find that people have different accents is because we're not really taught by mother tongue English speakers.
Sure.
So everybody was taught. So you have a variety of accents in Uganda. So in schools, we had to speak English, and that's how I learned English. But at home, you speak your vernacular language.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So then I get to America, and I had family. So other than my sister, I have my stepmom who was in Boston, and then, you know, my step siblings. And in Uganda, there is a in Boston, there is a large community of, especially my mother's age group, they work with elderly. So they do a lot of elderly care. And the way I got to know Doug's family is because my stepmom asked me if I could cover for her while she was away. And I remember her telling me the reason why she didn't want to use any other person of her friends, because she said, "I've seen this, like if you go away, you come back and somebody has taken your job." And she didn't want that. And she knew for me I was temporary and I would not take her job. So sure. I said, yeah, this works out well for me. And the times were perfect because I would go to school during the day and then I would work overnight and then go to school. So I had to change my schedule somehow. The first time, you know, that semester was kind of hard, but that's how I was doing it. So I was taking the night shifts, which were from 10 to 7 a.m. Oh, wow. And then while I'm there, I think I got a chance to, you know, to meet Dad's mom and then took care of Dad's dad. But at the same time, I had my life, you know, school life, and and I, you know, I kept on going back and forth to Italy to visit my family. And then I met Doug. He was there shortly for a recovering from a knee surgery, and that's how I met him.
Ah, and that's actually, if we could, right now I want to switch over to Doug and follow up on that very thing. Because Doug, in your bio, you mentioned your parents introduced, I think you put introduced in quotes, so I'm curious how that came about. How did it come about that your parents introduced you to Barbara?
So my father was in hospice care. He was at home, and he was a strong, sometimes stubborn man, and hospice care went on for almost 2 years, I think. So it was a long time. We had, as Barbara said, her stepmother taking, we had her living at our house and taking care of my father. And I used to go down quite a bit from, I was living in Vermont, and I'd go down a lot of weekends. And then one weekend, Barbara's there, you know, helping to take care of my father. That's how she supported herself going to Northeastern. As an I-20, that's the student visa that you have to have. And if you're a foreign student and you're going to college in the U.S., you can't get any kind of scholarships or anything like that, financial aid. You have to pay for school. So Barbara paid for school and was working her way through school and taking care of my dad, and walked in one day, and there she was, curled up on his special chair that only he was allowed to sit in our house. And going and sleeping one day. That's the first time I saw her. And that was it.
Love at first sight, huh?
Because from Vermont, I'd work and I'd come down on Friday nights, and I'd get home. I'd get back to my parents' house in Boston, you know, at sometimes 11, 12 at night, sometimes later. And that's the first time I saw Barbara. Yeah.
So, you know, we might have wanted to interview the two of you on our program just because you are interesting people, and also as an example of a happily married couple raising teenage kids these days, which is kind of, you know, remarkable all by itself in some ways. But of course, we're especially interested in how you're being an interracial and intercultural couple affects your life here in Vermont, which is, as many people know, one of the least diverse states in terms, at least in terms of race, one of the least diverse states in the country. Could you speak to that some? Like, what is... I'm sure you have stories around those issues. What could you speak to that?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a very, very complex question. The dynamic that we face most frequently is directed at racism towards our kids. And that's sort of where it intersects for us. As a couple, I guess it's interesting. If you go down into downtown Burlington or Shelburne or the suburbs of Burlington in Chittenden County, there's not a lot of overt racism. So I can't say that I've experienced, when we're walking down the street, that people are like, what the heck is this couple doing together? They shouldn't be together. And you actually see some few number of mixed race couples in if you're down on Church Street, for example, in downtown Burlington. From my experience, the racism has hit me more as it's been directed to kids. And I guess as somebody who grew up in a suburb of Boston, and Boston was a very racially segregated area at that time. And in fact, as one of the first Jewish families in the town I grew up in, Jews were separated in the neighborhoods that realtors would show them property. There were two neighborhoods where anybody who was Jewish lived in the town I grew up in, and that was it. And as somebody, I guess, who grew up in a very white neighborhood, I had no contact and no expectation, really, of what kind of racism may be directed at my kids based on my own experience. And it's shocking when you get into it. The assumptions that are made about things like basic intelligence level, or if there's behavioral issues going on in the classroom, who gets targeted first? There's issues about if something happens in the schoolyard. And our son, for example, has been attacked a couple of times, and how the school will address issues like that. So it's shocking the degree to which the systemic racism and attitudes of people affect their views on our kids. That surprises me the most, and that affects me the most.
Yeah. And so Barbara, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I would say I would agree that as a couple, I also haven't felt any issues. It's been pretty much the kids, but not directed towards us as the parents. But then I also, like with time, and I would tell you, we're talking about like 2 years ago, maybe, where I've felt as an individual, I've been targeted, and it blew my mind because I'm like, I've been here all this time and I never saw myself. Of course, I'm different, but I never thought like anybody would kind of target me in that way. I ran for office to represent my community. I was asked by our school principal to address the graduating class. And, you know, and I thought, thank you for the opportunity. And because there have been school board members who have been giving these speeches addressing the graduating class. And I thought, wow, what an opportunity. Thank you so much. It's a privilege and so on. So I plan, I think, I figure out how the speech is going to be. And the day of the graduation, there is a reporter. So the principal speaks. I'm the second adult speaker. And there are some kids on the student council who gave speeches. Not all of them were reported about, but the reporter decides to just talk about the principal and the students who spoke. And I thought, I could not believe it. And the reason I also, it was so painful, was because I had met, like a week after graduation, we were at the spot on the dock, and I met some kids who graduated. And a kid came to me, a kid I never even knew. Well, I know the face. And he said, that was a beautiful speech. And hearing that from the kid and seeing this reporter writing a whole report in our newspaper, I had to do something about it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Doug usually is the first one to hear my calls when such things happen. And I'm like, all right, you know, I have to call somebody, and what do I do? And then he kind of guides me, you know, who is the first person to call. But, you know, but I never experienced that. I mean, we had issues with the kids at school. And, you know, I ran on that platform on diversity and inclusion. That's why I ran for office. And, you know, I feel like we are not yet there, but I felt we'll get there as long as, you know, we get everybody on board and start working towards that that goal. We'll get there around, you know, diversity and inclusion. And then this comes to me, and it never occurred to me that somebody could target me. And not, they didn't do it purposely because it's Barbara.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's because of what their belief is. And I did follow up and speak to the reporter, and he said, I had this number of words I had to pick whom to report on. And it showed what was important for that person. And my questions to this person were, did you do a research in that community? When you report on something, do you do a research on that community? Like, what are they looking for? Like, one of the things we've been trying to improve is diversity and inclusion and all that. And, you know, we are working a lot, like in the school, with a diversity committee, which includes teachers, parents, you know, try to improve, to make sure that everybody understands what it's about. And then we have a reporter reporting and just leaving out my name. So I had to do something, which I did. But other than that, yeah, as a couple, I never felt, I've never felt anybody or anything targeting us.
So it sounds like there's a long way to go in terms of educating people on diversity.
Yes.
Boy, don't we? Yeah.
It's interesting, you know, Barbara, when you're describing your experience, you know, to me as, you know, having grown up American and Jewish and white, you know, all of those things and the various ways those things intersect. It's interesting to me because the vast majority of the people of color that I know grew up, you know, African American. And of course, you grew up African and became American. And it's interesting to me to hear you describing, you know, the relative lack of individual racism that you've experienced, you know, at least overtly. And it kind of leads into a question I want to ask you both, which is, you know, this is something I hear lots of people of color talking about when they're raising kids, especially boys, the talk, do you know? How do you handle the talk? It's, you know, the talk about, okay, if you're stopped by a police officer, what do you do? And, you know, the sort of thing that people of color have to do that white people don't have to do with their kids. And I'm sort of curious, how do you handle that?
Yeah, so we told stories. Maybe I should back up a little bit. So we told stories, but there are other things that, you know, I've told the kids. Because when you say that talk, it's not just about like when the police stops you. There are other talks like, you know, when you're in a school, you know, you have to make sure you always have to be the best, believe it or not. You can't be in the middle, in the bottom. You have to always be the best. Do your best. Or for example, like the hoodie, the, you know, putting on the hood, you know, that I didn't have, like, I never experienced that, but that's something with time I learned and telling the kids, like telling, especially Eli, you can't go out and put on the hood because it doesn't, you, it seems like you're hiding something. And I've kind of messaged that in a way that if I met you and you're putting on a hood and I'm talking to you, you know, are you hiding something? I'm not seeing your whole face. The other thing is like also is looking somebody in the eye, you know, when you're talking to them. So those are all, I know they are little talks, but those are all talks that kind of, I don't know if every parent that has, you know, doesn't have kids of color is messaging that or focusing on that. And it's my daily talk, you know, so I tell the kids and now with time, you know, I've learned, hey, even when the police, especially when you get into their driving, they're setting to drive, that you know where you put your hands. You can't, you know, get a phone. You can't get a hairbrush. You can't, you know, try to reach for something. So you need to put your hands. But, you know, this message continues. And, you know, back to your question, that talk is a big talk because there are so many things involved. Education, the way you present yourself, the way you talk, the way you, you know, you dress when you're in public and all that stuff. And it's a huge talk that probably will never end. And maybe, you know, as they hear it, as they hear this message, I hope that it's something they will remember.
Yeah. So there's a couple things that the conversation started many, many years ago. You know, I would say when our son, who's now 15, almost 16, about ready to get his license. I think the conversation with him started in earnest 7 years ago when he was 8. And it's not a one conversation. It's multiple conversations and ongoing. Because what you're really trying to do is prepare them for that moment. When we hear stories of friends being stopped here in Shelburne on Route 7, simply because they're people of color. So at some point, you have to expect that that's going to happen to him. If you look at traffic statistics in Vermont, the number of stops for Black people compared to any other group it's something like 4 times higher. Mm-hmm. So you have to expect something like that to happen. And so it's not a single conversation. It started a long time ago. It keeps going. And we will keep having that conversation for a number of years. I from my standpoint, I guess the most indelible interaction I've had with the police happened when I was in college. I was walking home from a women's college to my fraternity that I was living at. and through Kenmore Square in Boston. And I was with two other fraternity mates. And we came upon a group of people that were beating up one black person. And the policeman was standing right there, 5 feet away, watching it happen, and clearly enjoying the moment. And we broke it up and left the scene, basically told the policeman to do his job. And what happened? The policeman just let this group of attackers go, who then came around and drove the car and jumped us, the three of us. And we got beaten up. So I've had many good interactions with policemen since, but that's the one that, you know, that I remind our kids about, that you don't know where these police officers, where their heads are at, what their training is, what their upbringing is, what their inbuilt prejudices may be. And you have to be able to react in a way under pressure, assuming the worst. So that's part of the messaging we've been giving our kids for a really long time. And it's scary. Mm-hmm. I will just tell you, as a parent, and you read all the news and the George Floyd situation and everybody else that's happened even since then, that's just the last couple months. It's scary, and you wonder every day if your kids are going to be safe. And yeah, that is all the other teenage stuff that's going on. And that's probably the hardest thing as a parent to have to deal with.
I hear you describing this. It's so interesting because I'm thinking of my experience raising three boys, white and Jewish boys in Vermont, and never had any of those kinds of conversations. We would have conversations about occasional incidences of anti-Semitism, sometimes subtle and sometimes overt. But it was never any fear of the police. Do you know what I mean? My kids, and this is, you know, sort of the classic description of white privilege, the very fact that we didn't have to have those conversations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. No, and I didn't have any of those conversations growing up either. And in fact, I remember a small town again where I grew up. And, you know, as a high schooler, you'd go to a Saturday night party, and there was always one kid who would get very drunk every night at all these parties. And there was always a police officer at the party who would follow him home. This kid would get back in his, it was a VW bug. He would get back in his VW bug and drive home.
Oh, God.
And the policeman was always there to follow him home and make sure he got there safely.
Wow.
You know? Yeah. So that's a white privilege. That's how things work for me growing up.
Mm-hmm.
These conversations were the farthest thing from our mind.
Yeah. I'm curious because I know my own personal reactions to this awakening that's happened, and I'd call it an awakening for white Americans because, you know, people of color have had to know about racism, like it or not, the way Jews have had to know about anti-Semitism, like it or not. But there are some clear differences, as we were just describing, between the effects of anti-Semitism on white Jews and the effects of racism on people of color. There's also some similarities, too. I've noted that, you know, even since the George Floyd incidents, it really did touch on a strand of, I suppose I could call it Jewish paranoia, except it isn't paranoia because it's based on real stuff. So I was certainly feeling that. But again, there are also a lot of differences too. And Barbara, you are not only a person of color in a very white area, but you're also a Jew in a very non-Jewish area. And I'm curious if you can speak to any of those similarities or differences.
Yeah, so fortunately, I believe, you know, having, and I'm going to say maybe religious foundation is very critical, important in one's life or even in a relationship, which, you know, coming to the U.S., I didn't realize that everybody's kind of on their own. So you make that decision on your own, because I used to feel like everybody should have this. Like you build a family on a belief. You know, you have to have that, you know, you must believe in somebody, you know, believe in God. So I personally, having chosen to be Jewish, was partly because I believed that I needed to build my relationship with Doug, now have family, have kids. I needed to have a foundation. And either it was going to be I was born Catholic, either it had to be Catholic, but then I felt it's kind of hard because by the time I moved to the U.S., I wasn't necessarily practicing Catholicism because I lived with my stepmoms before and they were born again. And then when I moved to the U.S., they were born again. So I had like a different environment on religion. And in my culture, actually, once you get married, usually the kids take your husband's belief. Mm. So you would even ask, like, what if he was a Muslim? Would you do that? Yes, I would do it. If I wanted my kids to be part of their education, I would do it. And because everybody might take different paths, but we all believe in the same God, whether you are Muslim, you are in Christian, or you, whatever it is. And some people might say, I don't believe, but you know, why is it sometimes you might say that, hey, help me with this, somebody you're talking to. But we all take one, we take different roles, but we are leading to some belief, somebody who is power.
Right, a higher power.
Yes, a higher power. And so I personally, I think, felt, you know, it was critical to take a path. And okay, with my culture, you know, traditions where I had to decide whether we bring up the kids, you know, Jewish, and what's my role in that. It's something that I kind of just believed and said, I have to do this. And
so
I hope I answered your question there.
I'll confess, it was all Barbara who decided to. It's not something we talked about. She said, I want the kids to be brought up Jewish. And it was not something I really considered. I'm pretty secular. I was bar mitzvahed and really hadn't been to synagogue since. So, you know, that's well over 40 years ago.
The American Jewish story.
So it was pretty surprising to me. I mean, it's been a wonderful and I would say important addition to how we bring the kids. It's added depth and dimension to our ability to raise the kids and what they've been exposed to. So it's been a wonderful thing from my perspective. It's been a wonderful
and
thing.
I just want to put in President Doug, he's your president of our congregation. Your comment in your bio that you're the most secular president, you know, that you know of. I'll tell you who I thought of was my own father, may he rest in peace, who was the president of our conservative congregation in Buffalo. And He was also very secular, but very involved. And I think, you know, what your comment really made me think of him, that no, it isn't about necessarily belief or even religious practice per se, but there's a sense of being a part of a community. And that's how somebody who's quite secular and hasn't been to synagogue since his bar mitzvah ends up being president of the congregation.
Yeah, and that's exactly, it's community. I mean, ultimately, that's really what it is. And we do. We have an amazing community.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Bruce. I appreciate that. Anytime I get associated with your father is knowing you, that's a real compliment. So thank you.
Yes, I certainly meant it that way.
And I can tell you, you are not the most secular president we've had.
That's true, too, by the way. even at Temple Sinai, that's true.
Well, okay, that's good. I don't quite feel that guilt now that I...
No, don't feel guilt. You know, everybody brings something to the table. So,
So Bruce, did I answer your question? I just want to make sure that I addressed it right.
Yeah, well, you certainly talked about your own experience. I'm especially curious about, I can speak to some of my own experiences of anti-Semitism, because it's interesting to me, you know, there's this inner conflict that goes on in myself when I'm realizing I don't like to complain about anti-Semitism, especially to people of color in this country, because if one had to rate the degree of severity, most of the time, although there are big exceptions, but most of the time, anti-Semitism isn't as bad as racism. At least I say that coming from the Jewish perspective, not the perspective of a person of color. But it's still there. It's very much there. And I'm curious, either of you, what your experience is. I suppose especially Doug, because, you know, you did grow up with that experience.
Yeah.
And how that, I mean, even broaden the question too, which is how do those differences of background, which relate to things like experiences of racism or experiences of antisemitism, how do you get through that in terms of the day-to-day business of being a couple and having a happy marriage? Because, you know, you're going to come from different viewpoints sometimes, and you're going to be affected in different ways with different degrees of anxiety, I would imagine. I'm just curious about that, too. So that's a very broad question, but take it anywhere you'd like to go.
Yeah. So I mean, I think you're hitting the nail on the head, though, Bruce, mm-hmm. is that for me, often the springboard, the jumping off point for understanding racism is anti-Semitism I've experienced, or, you know, the community I grew up in experienced. So that's a tie-in or, a connection point. But I think you're also right that generally it's a lot less heavy-handed in the U.S. anti-Semitism is than bigotry and racism and the targeting of African-American and Black people. And so they're really, in some respects, worlds apart. Before I try to answer the second part, I just want to jump back to something else you said, Bruce. There's a lot of things that are not similar about racism and anti-Semitism. But one of the places that there is a real similarity, and I think an important one, is that ultimately, and I think history supports this, is you cannot ever deny your heritage, right? Yeah, I mean, if you're Jewish, then, you know, what they showed in Nazi Germany was if you were a Jew three generations ago, then you're a Jew today, and we're going to persecute you for that. So you can't, I think in both cases, you can't ever, and certainly, you know, what was the rule? If you're 1/7 Black, then you couldn't ever be considered voting rights and everything like that. So there's a long history in both cases where if you have any kind of connection in your distant past history that defines you today. So I think in both cases, you can't really ever deny your heritage. And I think that's one of the places that Barbara and I understand, you know, I think implicitly. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons that so far it's worked for us is we both recognize that we bring that past to our current relationship and try to work through it. And when you make that acknowledgement, you have to understand that there are different points of view and different perspectives, and you're going to approach things in some respects differently. The flip side of that, I would say, is that really, when you get down to it, our fundamental values, Barbara and my fundamental values, are really pretty similar, you know, in terms of what we want for the kids and how we to raise them. And, you know, I would think in today's world that we would both be termed pretty old school. So we have a lot of meeting points as well mm-hmm. that we just sort of naturally agree on.
So I would say that for me personally, I'm fortunate that we are living in Vermont. So it's a small bubble. And I have a community that hasn't made me feel any different. I would tell you that I'm pretty much in these, how many, 16 years we've been members of Temple Sinai. I'm the only person pretty much of color, unless there is somebody else I'm missing. But so I've never seen myself or looked around and said, oh, I'm different than anybody, because the community has welcomed me and has not seen me any different. And whether they see me of a different color or not, or they don't see the color, I don't know. But I have never felt otherwise. So I'm very fortunate. And back to your question, Bruce, you know, the anti-Semitism, I think there is a lot of history to learn on that. And I would tell you, like, you know, even though I chose to be Jewish, you go through that process of learning to be a Jew, but there is so much to learn and understand, and the history is just, there is so much history there. I would say that the one thing that really made me feel, wow, who could treat people like this, is seeing it in person when we were in Auschwitz with the kids in 2000, I forget when we were in Italy. And so we went to Auschwitz, and seeing that was life for me, you know. Again, you know, some people read books but sometimes for me, I grew up like people telling me stories. So live things even make a big impact to me, you know. So seeing that, it became a living reason why I understand, wow, the Jews went through a hard time. And this is something that is, it's a scar. Like, you know, you get a wound, it's a scar. It's hard to heal from something like that.
It's a cultural trauma.
It is a trauma. And this, we're talking about all generations differently. That's why it's important for kids, I hope, you know, parents who have grandparents and all that, these kids are hearing that history, that stories, storytelling, because that's how you can learn. I mean, the books are great, you can read, but hearing it firsthand from your grandfather or grandmother that escaped, of their generation, somebody escaped those camps. I mean, that's huge. So again, you know, to your story, I'm fortunate I'm in Vermont, so I haven't been exposed to a lot of that anti-Semitism. But I know it's there. So I'm fortunate, you know, the community doesn't see me any different and all that. But I have a lot to learn. And I fear that if we were any, you know, any place in these big cities, it's even worse, you know.
So are there other things you'd like us to be asking you about?
So, I mean, there's one thing that I think is a distinction that's meaningful is, you know, Barbara grew up in Uganda, not in the United States. So there's a different perspective of racism that she brings to the table, I think, than might be prevalent in an African-American, right? Somebody who grew up here.
Do you want to address
that's
Barbara?
That's true, because... Yeah. I never thought like anybody could see you any different. And what I'm seeing here, it's you know, I can't believe it. Because in Uganda, we were colonized by the British. And the way we see, and whether it's right or wrong, the way we see the person, another person, you know, a white person is... we give them respect. And I would tell you that this is throughout. Even now, I would think, you know, if that white person is there, you know, talking to this generation, there is some kind of respect. Like, you don't, you know, you don't see that person as under you, or maybe now they colonized us, like, you know, talk to them with anger. So there is that. And I'm not saying maybe relationship, but there is that kind of, yes, maybe they might have a better, something better that I can learn from, you know, like looking at it positively. That's what I think. And I can speak for everybody from Uganda. One thing that I would tell you that is growing up, it wasn't just your nuclear family, you know, it was anybody in your neighborhood, anybody who could see you and discipline you. And they had the right to say something about that. And actually, I've had Dag also mention this as he was growing up, which we don't have anymore. So it took that village to bring up a child, and that's what it is. And now we don't have that anymore. It's all about me.
Yeah, I was, funny you should say that. I was listening to Michelle Obama's podcast just yesterday, and that's what she and Barack were talking about, that feeling of growing up where you had the village, you know, you do something wrong, the lady down the street is going to make sure your mother knows it by the time you get
home. She's going to see me when I'm out there. And that's how it was. And we can you imagine? So Michelle Obama was in Chicago, I was in Uganda, and that's how it was. We're talking about, you know, almost 50 years ago.
Yeah, that's how it was. And I was
and
in Long Beach, you know.
And it's very critical. And unfortunately, we don't have that. So how do you engrave your kids to understand that as you act outside, you're taking ownership and you're representing your family or your parents? And it's a tough one. Maybe that's another podcast.
Yes, and it may well be. And I have to say that that particular aspect of what you just said sort of rings my Jewish chimes a lot. You know, it's like that sense that anybody who is recognizably Jewish does is a reflection on the entire people, whether you like it or not. And I grew up with that idea. And I think that, you know, we probably share that concept. Well, Barbara and Doug, thank you so much for doing this. This has really been great, and we really look forward to hearing more of your stories as we encounter you, and perhaps indeed another time on the podcast.
Great. Love to do some more. Thank you, Bruce and Judy.
Yeah. Thank you. Truly appreciate
it. Oh, thank you. It was so great having you here, and I'm sure we can come up with a whole other conversation. So this was wonderful.
Thank you again.
Well, we hope you enjoyed that interview as much as we did. And I just want to remind you that we do solicit questions from our listeners. If you have questions that you would like me and Bruce to talk about, you can email bruce@brucechalmer.com or visit brucechalmer.com, and maybe we'll help you solve some of your problems.
And when you visit brucechalmer.com, if you go to the podcast tab, you will note that we are also looking for suggestions about interesting folks to interview, and perhaps that includes you yourself. So if you'd like to suggest yourself or anybody else, you can do that through that podcast tab. There's even a place where you can sign up for a time for us to interview you. And in the process of doing that, we'll ask you what you'd like to be interviewed about, and that'll help us determine if you're a good fit for the program. So we hope you will do that and also tell your friends about that. So Judy, tell us about our next program.
Our next program, we will continue our exploration of faith from our formula, Be Kind, Don't Panic, and Have Faith.
Yeah, we're into the faith section. And I think I've mentioned before, that's really the most distinguishing, I think anyway, the most distinguishing characteristic of my book. There's lots of good books on relationships out there. I think I wrote one too. But really what distinguishes mine is how I talk about faith in the context of couple relationships. And it doesn't have to be religious faith, but I do say it's a central part of what I write about, that faith is very important in relationships. So we hope you will tune in for that. And again, just mentioning the book, the title of the book, Reigniting the Spark, Why Stable Relationships Lose Intimacy and How to Get It Back. It's available in paperback. It's available for Kindle. It's available as an audiobook. Wherever you get your books, and I hope you will get the book and enjoy it and send us comments. So if you've been enjoying these podcasts and would like to help spread the word, please do comment and rate and like and share our posts on social media, because that's how people hear about things these days. And so until next time,
remember, be kind,
don't panic,
and have faith.